For about 8 years or so, there have been some in this church who've wanted to have a seminar of some type, an annual seminar, in which we would help the people of our church and the people of the community grow in the grace and knowledge that is known in our Lord. And the particular focus of these seminars has been the idea of truth, goodness, and beauty. And these three attributes are ones that have been foundational for Christianity, and they tell us about who God is and what He has done, both in creation and in redemption. And it really follows from the verse in Philippians 4:8 that we're likely familiar with, just in obedience to that particular verse, which says, "Finally, brethren, whatever is true, whatever is honorable, whatever is just, whatever is pure, whatever is lovely, whatever is commendable, if there is any excellence, if there is anything worthy of praise, think about these things." And so Ken Myers is here tonight to help us think about these very things, particularly about beauty and the gift that has been largely abandoned by the modern church. Now, Ken holds a B.A. in film studies from the University of Maryland. He has a Master's of Arts degree in religion at Westminster Theological Seminary. And he has worked for NPR, for Eternity Magazine, for various philanthropic organizations, and as well as editorial projects. In 1992, he started his own company, which is Mars Hill Audio. You can easily find it online just by Googling Mars Hill Audio. But it's a unique audio journal that examines this intersection of the Christian faith and culture. And in fact, the very first paragraph on their website pretty much explains the mission of that particular organization and Ken's focus for really the past 20 years. And it is this: we believe that fulfilling the commands to love God and neighbor requires that we pay careful attention to the neighborhood. That is, every sphere of human life where God is either glorified or despised, where neighbors are either edified or undermined. Therefore, living as disciples of Christ pertains not just to prayer, evangelism, and Bible study, but also our enjoyment of literature and music, our use of tools and machines, our eating and drinking, our views on government and economics, and so on. Ken is married to his wife, Kate, and they have two children, live in Virginia. His entire three-part lecture series here at Sylvania is entitled Abandoning God's Gifts, the Tragedy of Modern Suspicion About Beauty. Tonight's lecture is Life, the Universe, and Everything, Why the Gospel Means More Than a Ticket to Heaven. Ken?
Thank you, Randy. I'm glad to be here. I think it was almost exactly a year ago the first time Randy called me to begin exploring this, so it's kind of an interesting fulfillment of a long pilgrimage. It probably feels a lot longer for him and for me and other folks who have been planning this. I should say by way of introduction that because of the work I do, I'm a generalist. I'm not a specialist. I interview people on all sorts of subjects, and I have to be something of a dabbler. And so, and I'm often, because of the fact that the guests I interview authors of books. The format of our principal product is for me to find really, really smart people who've written really brilliant books about something, and then I interview them. And then I sound smart because I've asked them some good questions. But they've done all the heavy lifting. And then I get invited to speak on subjects that actually I'm not the expert on, but I have been. I feel like I'm often like Lewis and Clark. I'm out kind of surveying and reconnoitering and coming back and reporting on things. So I'm not an expert, although I have spent most of my adult life thinking about the arts and professionally involved in the arts. When I was at National Public Radio, I was in the Arts and Performance Division and then became Arts and Humanities Editor for Morning Edition, a morning news program. And since then, I've served on panels for the National Endowment for the Arts. When I talk about my work at NPR, I sometimes suggest that I was the token fascist at NPR. People often say, how are you working at NPR? You're a Christian. But actually, it was an interesting position to be, because here I was a conservative Christian, but I was the arts guy, and they couldn't figure that out, because the arts guy is usually the real liberal on the far end, and I was, I had a Bible on my desk. They could not figure this out. So as Randy said, the title for tonight's lecture is Life, the Universe, and Everything. why the gospel means more than a ticket to heaven. There's always a danger in giving a title to a lecture before you finish writing it. You may promise more than you can find you can actually deliver when the time comes. Now, I pretty much promised everything, life, the universe, and everything. So, I mean, you can't get any more comprehensive than that. Or you may fail to promise something that you've discovered in your reflection and studies and actually, here's something I wish I'd put in that title. As I've thought about this dilemma, and I face it often because I'm often asked months ahead of time, or I'll be asked to write a paper on something, and they say, you know, come up with a title, you can write the paper later. I think that giving titles to things like books or titles to chapters or subheadings within chapters or names of radio programs or names of magazines or names of academic programs or job titles or even names of children, maybe pets even, all of these, and maybe especially the last one, maybe other naming tasks seem like hard work to me. It's often very hard to name. In fact, I've been in the position where I've tried to give names to new radio programs when I was at NPR. And I thought, it's harder to name a radio program than it is to name your children. Now, since that's hard work, it suggests that Adam didn't really spend all his time relaxing in the Garden of Eden. He was given this task of naming, too, and I wonder if he fretted over it. Now, the title of this series I'm happy with, Abandoning God's Gifts, The Tragedy of Modern Suspicion About Beauty. I wish I'd added something about a prologue to beauty, because as I worked on these lectures, I realized that I'm just beginning. This is kind of very, very, very introductory to this topic. A prologue, a prologos, is something that's said in front of something else that you're going to say. And I think that what I will end up doing in these three talks is not so much presenting a summary of everything that needs to be said about beauty, but offering the sorts of things I think need to be said before we can talk fruitfully about beauty. As in the case of gardening, there's a lot of soil preparation, there's a lot of weed clearing, and maybe even some stump pulling that's necessary before Christians can explore the idea of beauty well. I think we're very much captive, and this will come across in tomorrow morning's lecture also. I think we're very much captive to the conventional wisdom in our culture about the nature of beauty. And I think that that puts us in a bad position. Now, the day I dreamed up that title, The Tragedy of Modern Suspicion About Beauty, it must have been one of the days when I was particularly sad about all the missed opportunities in people's lives to experience particular forms of beauty. I think one of the reasons I went into radio originally was because I love sharing things with people. And when I see or hear something really beautiful, particularly here because I've been involved in music most of my life, I just want to share it with somebody. Basically, my inner disc jockey wants to spin the platter for someone else. And I think that's actually an aspect of beauty that I find very intriguing, that it has a kind of a capacity for giving, and I'll talk in a minute more about the giving quality that's related to beauty. But often I think we have a lot of missed opportunities to experience particular forms of beauty because we're so distracted or we're so preoccupied with really trivial things. I mean, how many hours have we spent playing Angry Birds when we could be, you know, reading a wonderful poem or looking at a beautiful painting or listening to some remarkable music? I say this as confession, not accusation. But I do think that it's easy for us to crowd our lives up with things that distract us and displace the possibilities of beauty in our lives. I think that's a sad thing. But I think it's even sadder the extent to which, for a long time, modern culture has been very suspicious about the idea of beauty. What I hope to make clear in these lectures is that the indifference to or relativizing of beauty that is present in our culture is very much related to the relativizing of truth and goodness in our culture. And I think it's not a good thing for Christians to say, well, beauty's just in the eye of the beholder. which just think, if somebody said truth is in the eye of the beholder or goodness is in the eye of the beholder, you probably wouldn't be as sanguine about that. And I think that the reasons our culture has come to the conclusion that beauty is in the eye of the beholder is very similar to the reasons that have brought us to relativism about other things. And I hope to be able to make that clear over these three lectures. And if I don't make it clear, I'll recommend some books that do, because I've been told I have the gift of bibliography. That's my spiritual gift, which isn't on any of those lists, but I try to exercise it. Now, I know when I talked about abandoning God's gifts, I know that I was thinking a lot at the time when I came up with that title of the theme of how beauty relates to the idea of gift, that it really is that the beautiful things are a gift. And I want to talk about that a little bit more in a second. Whatever else it is, our experience of beauty is tied to our perception of things through our senses, either natural objects, things in nature, or works crafted by human artists and artisans. The experience of beauty ties us to creation, even as it lifts us up beyond the limits of our material lives. And so what we have to say about beauty must be tied to what we believe about creation. And creation is the ultimate gift of God. I'll talk more about this in a minute. What we have to say about beauty is also, I think, tied very much to what we believe about the incarnation, about the fact that the Word became flesh. Now, I have a hunch that many American churchgoers don't hear a lot of sermons about the incarnation, except maybe at Christmas time. I think that the incarnation is often treated as the necessary precondition to Christ's death and resurrection. Well, of course, the Word became flesh because he had to die. But we kind of leave it at that the only reason the incarnation is important was so that Jesus could die. The only reason he took human form was to die, period, and that it has no other significance. Well, throughout the centuries, Christian theologians have found a lot more significance in the fact that the Word became flesh. That, as Paul says in Colossians, the whole fullness of deity dwells bodily in Jesus Christ. This is a remarkable fact. And I said dwells. Paul uses the present tense. He uses the present tense writing after the ascension. We too must believe that the full deity, the fullness of deity, dwells in the body of a man. If we had another seminar on another topic, I'd love to spend time talking about the continuing reality of the incarnation. The incarnation doesn't end with the ascension. The God-man, Jesus Christ, is still the God-man. And that's another thing I often don't hear sermons about the fact, and this is what the church has always professed. We believe in the bodily return of Jesus, and we believe in the bodily ascension of Jesus, but then when we say, well, gee, how does he have a body now? I mean, it is a mystery. But the fact of the incarnation, I think, is remarkably important for a number of reasons. It's a great mystery, among other things, that elevates the importance of the material world. The world that we know through our senses. And I'm going to come back to why that's important in just a second. It's remarkable that God was known through people's senses. The opening of John's first epistle reads like this: that which was from the beginning, which we have heard, which we have seen with our eyes, which we have looked upon and have touched with our hands, concerning the word of life. The life was made manifest, and we have seen it. He's underscoring all these references to the senses. And testify to it and proclaim to you the eternal life which was with the Father and was made manifest to us. That which we have seen and heard, we proclaim also to you, so that you too may have fellowship with us. The physicality of Jesus, the fact that he could be perceived through sight and touch and hearing, the physicality of Jesus is utterly important in this epistle, as it is in John's gospel. When he says the Word was made flesh, he goes out of his way. He could have said the Word was made man. There are other words he could have used. But he goes out of his way to stress the raw physicality of the incarnation. And the fact that the glory of God is present to the senses is an amazing source of wonder. And John is so insistent about the centrality of the incarnation that the incarnation becomes the centrality of Christian faithfulness for him, the touchstone of faithfulness. In chapter 4, when John warns about false prophets and false spirits, he says, test the spirits. What's the test? Every spirit that confesses that Jesus Christ has come in the flesh is from God. And every spirit that does not confess Jesus, that is, does not confess the embodied Jesus, is not from God. This is the spirit of the Antichrist. The Antichrist is tied to the denial of the physicality of Jesus, which would seem to suggest that the physicality, the actual physical presence of Jesus, is a very, very important idea for John, an important reality for all of us. The spirit of the Antichrist is evident from the denial of the incarnation, the denial that God took human form, which could be seen and touched and heard. The glory of God perceived by the senses. Truly in the body of this man from Nazareth, as truly in the body of this man from Nazareth as it is in the heavens themselves that declare God's glory in physical form. Now I'm stressing this because, as we'll see later, one of the reasons there's a lot of skepticism about the objectivity of beauty, the idea that when we talk about beauty, we're talking about something that's really there, not just something that we feel is there, is because of the skepticism about the senses that emerges in modern philosophy, that the senses are unreliable, and so we can't trust them. Again, I keep saying more in a minute. I'm trying to give a prologue to my prologue here. The mysterious and apparently paradoxical quality of the incarnation was a source of great delight to the great English writer G.K. Chesterton. And particularly in his book on Thomas Aquinas, he insists that thanks to the incarnation, and here I'll read from Chesterton, there really was a new reason for regarding the senses and the sensations of the body and the experiences of the common man with a reverence at which even great Aristotle would have stared. And no man in the ancient world could have begun to understand. The body was no longer what it was when Plato and the old mystics had left it for dead. It had hung upon a gibbet. It had risen from a tomb. It was no longer possible for the soul to despise the senses, which had been the organs of something that was more than man. God had senses, he's saying. Plato might despise the flesh, but God had not despised it. The senses had truly become sanctified. Seeing is believing was no longer the platitude of a mere idiot or a common individual as in Plato's world. It was mixed up with the real conditions of real belief. Those revolving mirrors that send messages to the brain of man, I think he's referring to the eyes as revolving mirrors. I'm not quite exactly why I use that metaphor. Those revolving mirrors that send messages to the brain of man, that light that breaks upon the brain, these had truly revealed to God himself the path to Bethany, or the light on the high rock of Jerusalem. In other words, God perceived his own creation through human senses in the person of Jesus Christ. Chesterton goes on, those ears that resound with common noises had reported also to the secret knowledge of God the noise of the crowd that strewed palms and the crowd that cried for crucifixion. It's remarkably poignant. God is perceiving through human eyes and human ears these realities, and he's perceiving through human eyes and human ears his very rejection in the person of Jesus Christ. After the incarnation had become the idea that is central in our civilization. I don't think that's true anymore. It was inevitable that there should be a return to a serious value of matter and the making of the body. When once Christ had risen, it was inevitable that Aristotle should rise again. And what he means here, Aristotle put a lot of attention on the particularity of specific things in his philosophy, unlike Plato. So what he's saying is that there's a sense in which Aristotle's attention to the specific things, including specific material things, is resurrected in Jesus. Now, as we'll see later, the value given to materiality and this confidence in the senses to convey the highest realities is very important in the evolution of thought about beauty. Because in modern thought, the senses are increasingly regarded as unreliable. They can't actually reveal anything objectively real to us. David Bentley Hart, in his magnificent and remarkably difficult book, The Beauty of the Infinite, argues that the incarnation of the Logos reconciles us not only to God, but to the world by giving us back a knowledge of creation's goodness, allowing us to see again its essential transparency before God. And by transparency, he means we can see God through the stuff of creation. And that's confirmed. It's implied in the Old Testament. The heavens reveal the glory of God. I think it's implied in this odd account in 1 Kings chapter 4, where we read about Solomon's wisdom. And it talks about how Solomon's wisdom is expressed in his writings, and all of his writings, what do they deal with? Well, they deal with trees and birds and lizards and reptiles and fish. Solomon is wise because he's attending to the stuff of creation. He gets to wisdom, which is a divine gift. He gets to that wisdom by attending to the stuff of creation. And then this becomes radically confirmed with the incarnation. But David Hart notes in his book, this fundamental truth of the gospel was denied or forgotten by some in late medieval theology and by many in early modern theology and by most in later modern theology and philosophy. By the 17th century, René Descartes, a French philosopher who's a towering figure in shaping modern thought, Descartes believed it was necessary to deny and ignore the testimony of the senses if you wanted certain knowledge. If you really wanted to know the truth, you had to deny anything that came in from the senses. Reason alone, the slogan of the Enlightenment, one of the phrases associated with the Enlightenment, reason alone was reason that was deprived of aid from revelation and from tradition and from the senses. We couldn't rely on seeing or hearing or touching anything in the world to perceive anything that was ultimately real. You have to wonder what Descartes would have done if he'd lived in the first century and Jesus was there. The only way to certain knowledge was to retreat within your own mind. That was the only source for certain knowledge. So Descartes writes in one of his meditations, "Now will I close my eyes. I will stop up my ears. I will avert my senses from their objects. I will even erase from my consciousness all images of things corporeal. I'll even try to forget that I ever saw anything or heard anything. Or at least I will consider them to be empty and false." This really anxious desire he has for certainty. David Bentley Hart says that this is an act of self-mutilation. And if it's not the founding gesture of modernity, it's certainly the supreme crystallization of the logic of modernity. This is at the heart of what it means to be modern, to deny the capacity of embodied life to actually reveal something true and good and beautiful to us. The truth of the world could no longer be certified through the senses. And as, again, Hart points out, that beauty was the very reality that had to be made of no account. Beauty had to be dismissed as something that was just a subjective impression, just a feeling, or an ornamental fancy. Nothing more than that. And I hope you'll see in a minute why the testimony of beauty to the reality of God was so important, and why the denial of it, in the interest of exalting the freedom of individuals, became so important. I want to come back to that idea of gift that I referenced earlier, because I think that the idea of something being gratuitous, that is not necessary, is really important in the idea of beauty. Theologian Peter Leithart has commented that art is a kind of making that imitates the making of God, and it is most godlike when it is purely gratuitous, when it is not meeting a need. Now, practical Americans get a little nervous, something that's not practical, something that's not meeting a need. You're probably getting a little itchy already here. It doesn't answer any need. It's a good in and of itself. Well, the creation is gratuitous. The creation doesn't answer any need. God didn't need to make anything. It has the character of a gift. It was not something that God needed to do, but we rejoice and give thanks that he chose to do. This is why one of our sacraments is called the Eucharist, which is a Greek word for thanksgiving. We're giving thanks for a gift, the great gift of salvation, but also the great gift of creation, which I think is why we use the stuff of creation in the elements of the communion table to express that thanksgiving. And that meal, the Lord's Supper, is a symbol of a great feast that's set before us eternally, not because we deserve it and not even because we need it, but because God wants to give it to us. God's salvation could have been less extravagant and more perfunctory than a feast. Just as the wine that Jesus made, sorry to talk about wine in the Baptist church, there you are. Just as the wine that Jesus made from water could have been merely passable rather than really notably fine, as the inspired text of the gospel assures us that it was. The gifts that God gives are given generously and extravagantly and gratuitously. Now, when we receive a great gift, we're delighted in the gift and in the generosity of the giver. And delight's also a key word to attach to beauty, because as we'll see tomorrow morning when we look at ways people have described beauty, beauty evokes delight. It evokes marvel and wonder and delight. It evokes joy. And gifts similarly evoke delight, both in the gift and in the generosity of the giver. And I think it's the same way with powerful works of art. When I hear a thoughtful and attentive performance of a carefully crafted piece of music, or when I watch a masterfully constructed film, I often have a sense of gratitude, not just to the performers or the composer or the director, but I have a sense of gratitude to God. I'm grateful to live in a world where such joys are possible. The gratitude felt by the recipients of a gift resonates with the delight known by the giver of the gift. How delightful it is to give a gift, not because someone needs it, but just for the delight in the act of love. Now, that's a pattern built into creation, into our experience in creation. And I think it's a pattern built into creation. Well, I think this because a number of smarter people than I have said it is. It's a pattern built into creation because creation itself is the work of a dynamic and giving three-personed God. The members of the Trinity enjoy an eternal giving and receiving in their love of one another. The doctrine of the Trinity reminds us of the personality and the dynamism of God. And those qualities are suggested in the ancient term applied to the Trinity, particularly by the Greek fathers, the patristics. They use the term perichoresis. It's a word that's used to refer to the mutual indwelling of the persons of the Trinity. And you get a little glimpse of that indwelling if you read John 17 tonight. When you go home, read John 17, which is Jesus' remarkable prayer for the disciples on the night that he was betrayed. And he talks about this mystery of he is in the Father and the Father is in him. And the disciples are going to be joining in this union somehow. So you have this mutual indwelling of the persons of the Trinity, which is described as perichoresis. And by extension, that term perichoresis has been used to refer to God's relationship to the world, whereby everything is in him and he is in everything. And what I find interesting, that core in the word perichoresis is related to our word choreography. It's about dancing. Sorry to mention dancing in a Baptist church. Perichoresis, the idea of perichoresis suggests that the relationship among the persons of the Trinity is like a dance. The Father and the Son and the Holy Spirit are dancing around each other. There's joy. There's dynamism in the Trinity. God is not some static fixture, but he's a living, dynamic, giving, loving being. And the Christian life, which involves God in us and we in God, is our entry into the dance. We get to dance with God. David Bentley Hart, again, who I quoted before, he notes that while God was under no necessity to create, the act of creation flows out of the infinite love experienced by the members of the Trinity. He says God's gracious action in creation belongs from the first to the delight, pleasure, and regard that the Trinity enjoys from eternity. Creation is an outward and unnecessary expression of that love. Now, he very deliberately uses the words of delight and pleasure because he's writing a book ultimately about beauty, and beauty is a matter of delight and pleasure. Thus, creation, he writes, must be received before all else as gift and beauty. Creation is an act of beauty in itself because it is an act of God's sheer delight. He just delights in making what he has made, and he delights in what he has made. We see that in Genesis in the account at the end of each day, and it was good, it was good, it was good, it was very good. He's delighting in this. The giftness and the beauty of creation are expressions of the generous love that's enjoyed by our God, who is a God in three persons. Hart goes on to suggest that the relationships among the members of the Trinity are not only beautiful, they're beautiful in a way that has analogies with our experience of music. And I love the way he puts this. He says, as God is Trinity, in whom all difference is possessed as perfect peace and unity. There are three persons, but it's one God. The divine life might be described as infinite music, and creation too might be described as a music whose intervals, transitions, and phrases are embraced within God's eternal triune polyphony. Polyphony, multiple voices. Now, if Hart's right, then the presence of music in our worship and in our lives is witness to this deep reality of the Trinity. Art provides us with ways of perceiving reality aright, but not all art does this or does it well. But fundamentally, that idea of gift is central to the reality that art is and that beauty is. Take a little turn here. Florence, Italy. I've never been to Florence. Been to Florence? Okay. There's a stone building there that once housed a barracks and a prison. And my Italian is not very good. Is it Bargello or Bargello? Who knows? Bargello Palace. My guess is it's Bargello. It's from a Latin word, which my daughter, who studied a lot of Latin, assures me that the G is always hard. The Latin root is Bargillus. Bargillus is related to the German word Berg and Pittsburgh and lots of other Bergs, Harrisonburg, Virginia, where I live. Berg is a common suffix that forms the name of many cities. And a Berg is a fortified tower or a castle. Martin Luther's famous A Mighty Fortress is in German Ein Fester Berg. So the Bargello Palace was a fortress, and it looks like a fortress, but now it contains an art museum, I think now since the early 19th century. And the collection in the art museum at the Bargello contains the largest Italian collection of Gothic and Renaissance sculptures, including several works by Michelangelo and the Donatello's most famous work, the bronze statue of David, which dates back to the early 15th century. Now, let's connect this exotic site in Florence with Texas. Through the work of a Houston-born poet named B.H. Fairchild. Fairchild grew up in small towns and oil fields in Texas and Oklahoma and Kansas. He worked during high school and college with his father, who was a lathe machinist. And he somehow became a poet. And this is the beginning, the opening of a poem he wrote called Beauty. It's a long narrative. I'll read just part of it. And he writes in really long sentences, so try to stay with me. I'll try to inflect it so it makes sense. We are at the Bargello in Florence, and she says, "What are you thinking?" And I say, "Beauty." Thinking of how very far we are now from the machine shop and the dry fields of Kansas, the treeless horizons of slate skies, and the muted passions of roughnecks and Scrabble farmers, drunk and romantic enough to weep more or less silently at the darkened end of the bar out of, what else, loneliness, meaning the ache of thwarted desire of, in a word, beauty. Or rather, its absence. And it occurs to me again that no male member of my family has ever used this word in my hearing, or anyone else's, except in reference perhaps to a new pickup or a dead deer. This insight, this backward vision, first came to me as a young man, as some weirdness of the airwaves slipped through the static of our new Motorola with a discussion of beauty between Robert Penn Warren and Paul Weiss at Yale College. We were in Kansas eating barbecue-flavored potato chips and waiting for Father Knows Best to float up through the snow of rural TV in 1963. I felt transported, stunned. Here are two grown men discussing beauty seriously and with dignity, as if they and the topic were as normal as normal topics of discussion between men, such as soybean prices or why the commodities market was a sucker's game or Oklahoma football or Gimpy Niederlin's almost dying from his hemorrhoid operation. They were discussing beauty and tossing around allusions to Plato and Aristotle and someone named Pater, and they might be homosexuals. Later in the poem, Fairchild remembers this. "One time my Uncle Ross from California called my mom's Sunday dinner centerpiece lovely, and my father left the room." Clearly troubled by that word lovely, coupled probably with the very idea of California and the fact that my Uncle Ross liked to tap dance. The light from the Venetian blinds, the autumn silver Kansas light laving the table that Sunday, is what I recall now, because it was beautiful, though of course I would not have said so then, beautiful, as so many moments forgotten but later remembered come back to us in slants and pools and uprisings of light. Beautiful in itself, but more beautiful mingled with memory, the light leaning across my mother's carefully set table, across the empty chair beside my Uncle Ross, the light filtering down from the green plastic slats in the roof of the machine shop where I worked with my father so many afternoons, standing or crouched in pools of light and sweat with men who knew the true meaning of labor and money and other hard, true things and did not ever use the word beauty. This is, as I said, just the beginning. And I first discovered this poem in a book called Speaking of Beauty by literary critic Dennis Donahue. It's not a book about beauty. It's a book about how we talk about beauty or how we don't talk about beauty, why we are afraid to talk about beauty sometimes, how critics and artists and poets and philosophers and theologians have spoken about beauty in times past and in the present, the kind of vocabulary they use, the claims they make, the things they don't say, the associations they make with other ideas, and the reasons they offer for what they believe about beauty. Now, Fairchild in this poem is writing about a variety of manly discomfort with the idea and even the very word of beauty, a word and an idea crowded out by practical commitments to hard, true things. And it is in some ways a very American perspective and a very modern perspective. But I want to argue in these three lectures that it's not finally a Christian perspective. I want to argue that Christians have compelling reasons to resist the cultural forces that encourage us to regard beauty either as an effeminate luxury or as a purely subjective experience rooted entirely in our personal perspectives. I think that concerning matters that don't obviously relate to the salvation of individual souls or obvious moral issues, I think most American Christians tend to think about such things pretty much like their non-believing neighbors do. And I hope by the end of our time together you'll see why I think that represents an inadequate and an incomplete view of Christian discipleship. As I've begun to explain, what we believe about beauty is very much tied up with what we believe about creation, about God, and about God's relationship with creation. Changing ideas about the nature of beauty have reflected changing ideas about God and creation. When people have been very confident that creation in some way revealed God's reality and God's presence to us, then people regarded beauty with greater honor. Beauty was an objective reality. It was an attribute of creation because it was an attribute of God. But when people began to believe that creation is just a lot of meaningless raw material, and that God was neither involved in the ongoing life of creation nor revealed in the dynamic presence of creation, then beauty began to be treated as a matter of personal preference, as a frill or an ornament in life, and art began to be regarded as a form just of self-expression, not as an exploration of objective realities. Not to say I find it extremely odd that the same Christians who fight tooth and nail against teaching Darwinism in our schools, that is, who are fighting against a naturalistic understanding of human origins, often show no hesitation at all in accepting a naturalistic account of the nature of creation when it comes to the matter of beauty. Christians seem much more willing to fight for the fact of creation than they are to recognize and testify to the actual meaning and texture of creation in their cultural lives, which I find, again, kind of curious. This wasn't always the case. Christians used to be much more deliberate in exploring and honoring the shape of creation. Christians used to believe that Christian beliefs about God, about creation, about the incarnation, about the resurrection, about the second coming, about God's revelation in creation and history should all have consequences for how we think and act concerning such matters as beauty. And while there still are Christians who believe this, I think the vast majority of Christians are taking their cues about such matters from the common consensus of American culture. I want to take a little time to talk about cultural captivity, because that's a major concern in the work that I do. I think we're often captive to our culture in ways that we don't think matter because we have a relatively small idea of what the gospel is about. And that's what the title of this lecture. I believe the gospel is about life, the universe, and everything. It's not just a way to be forgiven. It is a way to be forgiven, and then because we're forgiven, it's about life, the universe, and everything. And I'll spend the rest of this lecture trying to defend that claim. I think that a lot of churches and parachurch ministries fail to communicate that the salvation that Christ secured for us is a salvation for us as whole men and women. Just as the denial of embodiment is considered by John to be the spirit of the Antichrist, so the importance of the communication to all of our embodied lives of the consequences of Christ's salvation is extremely, extremely important. It's not just our souls that are being saved, the immaterial aspect of our being. Our whole being is the benefit of Christ's work. And therefore, there's no aspect of our lives, of the way we organize life together, that isn't open to the scrutiny and challenge from the Creator and Redeemer of all things. Beginning around the time of the Enlightenment, the enemies of Christianity began to advance the idea that religion was only a private matter. Public life, including government, commerce, science, much of education, artistic pursuits, could all be organized according to principles of pure reason, unaided reason. Religion was private and subjective. Religion had nothing important to say about anything other than personal salvation and personal spiritual experience. And over time, this viewpoint, which was insisted upon by the enemies of Christianity, over time, this became the view of many Christians. I sometimes wonder whether a lot of our churches practice a form of Christianity that the ACLU actually would really love, that going to keep it private. Jesus is my personal Savior and nothing more. He's not his. The work he accomplished in his death and resurrection has no consequences beyond the personal life. So the irony is that many Christians behave as if the Enlightenment view of religion was valid. Let me look at a few examples of the way we tend to ignore a lot of things that are going on culturally. Education. For decades, there were views of education that really secularized education, that was taking any reference to any religious ideas out of curriculum. And Christians were never bothered. My parents, I grew up in the 1950s, and I think school was pretty well secularized even then. Of course, when the prayer was taken out of schools, there was some fuss about that. I grew up actually saying the Lord's Prayer. Some of you are old enough to remember doing that. But it's interesting that ideas about the nature of knowledge and the nature of learning that were miles away from historic Christian ideas were influencing the way teaching was conducted in this country. And most Protestant Christians just kept sending their kids to public schools. Only in the 60s, when school prayer was declared unconstitutional, did Christians suddenly care about public education. But prior to that, the influence of ideas of people like John Dewey were moving education far, far away from what Christians understood it to be, and Protestants just didn't pay attention. It's only when prayer was attacked. Now we'll get nervous. That is, only when an explicitly religious issue became obvious did Christians get upset. And I think this is true in a lot of areas of life. It's only when something explicitly religious is attacked that we pay attention. But meanwhile, all sorts of implicit things happen, and we just kind of ignore it. Consider in science, for centuries, ideas that science has promoted about the nature of knowledge, about the nature of nature, about the nature of human nature, were moving farther and farther away from Christian understanding. Science promoted a very mechanical model of nature and of human nature that has significantly dehumanizing consequences. But Christians pretty much ignored what science was doing until evolution became a big issue in schools, something that actually seemed to contradict what the Bible taught, something that had a more obvious religious connection. What about in the arts? Christians pretty much ignored trends for the last 200 years in the arts and only got upset when a guy named Andre Serrano put a crucifix in a vat of urine with National Endowment for the Arts funding. Only when the arts transgress across a line that is explicitly religious do Christians take notice, or explicitly, obviously moral. In literature, Christians generally ignore the substance of much fiction, both popular fiction and literary fiction. But when a book like The Da Vinci Code or the Harry Potter books come along that seem to make explicit religious claims, Christians get really energized. Never mind that all sorts of other books might advance all sorts of bad ideas about all sorts of other matters, like the nature of history or the nature of language or personal identity or all sorts of other things in which Christians do have a real interest. In economic life, we've seen many changes in the past century in the shape of capitalism that would have certainly bothered Augustine or Aquinas or Calvin or Wesley. But for the most part, as long as Christian businessmen have the freedom to have Bible studies and witness to their colleagues, it's business as usual. And finally, the world of sports, a world about which I know next to nothing. But I've read many thoughtful secular critics over the past few decades lament the loss of play and of sportsmanship, as professional sports have become more and more commercialized, more commodified, more driven by television. I don't think I've ever seen a Christian complain about the loss of play. In fact, the only time I've ever seen Christians respond to something regarding the world of sports is a few years ago when the NFL said it was going to prohibit churches from having Super Bowl parties and televising the game. Suddenly, Christians get upset. See, I see a kind of pattern here. It's only when our turf, our narrowly defined turf, it seems to be tread upon that we pay attention to what's going on. And I think there's a kind of dualism here. We have a compartment of life called religion, which is primarily concerned with personal and family matters, and Jesus is Lord over that little compartment. And meanwhile, we have all these other parts of life, economics, science, education, politics, art, pretty much everything except our private religious life. And everything beyond that narrow slice of life. And Jesus apparently doesn't seem to care about all much of that, except for general principles of morality. At least Christians often don't talk about how he might care about things. So the Lord of heaven and earth has been reduced to the Lord of my private life. Jesus cares about my soul, but not about all the settings within which my mind and my body are actively engaged. I thought of making a movie about this called Honey, We Shrunk the Lord. Now, last year, transition. When we don't pay attention to these things, what happens is we end up accepting the world's definition of these things and not realizing it. Unless we're deliberate and proactive in attending to these things, we end up absorbing what the status quo is, which is why I find a lot of young Christian people from evangelical backgrounds I speak at colleges who can't quite understand why people are so upset about gay marriage or homosexuality, generally speaking. Last year, one of the authors I had the pleasure of interviewing was a woman named Kenda Creasy Dean. She's associate professor of youth, church, and culture at Princeton Theological Seminary. She's actually a United Methodist. She worked with the National Study of Youth and Religion, a project directed by a sociologist named Christian Smith. That study was the most comprehensive survey of the religious lives of American teenagers ever conducted. Christian Smith wrote a book about the study's findings called Soul Searching, in which he said that almost every American teenager has the same religion. He called it moralistic therapeutic deism. It wasn't Trinitarian Christianity, even if they'd gone to raised in a Christian church, which is rather troubling. Kenda Creasy Dean helped work on the research for that project, and she wrote her own book, which was explicitly addressed to the church, and it was called Almost Christian: What the Faith of Our Teenagers is Telling the American Church. Now, for a while, I've used the phrase vaguely Jesus-y to describe the quality of a lot of Christian witness in our time. It's just kind of vaguely Jesus-y. It's not richly, robustly Christian. And Dean, she uses the phrase almost Christian. She actually uses the word Christian-ish to describe it. Kids are Christian-ish. She says there's a lack of definition in the lives of many young people. But she says it's not their fault. It's because they haven't been taught really well. And there's probably a lack of definition in their parents' lives as well. Their parents are probably moralistic therapeutic deists. Part one of the book is called Worshiping at the Church of Benign Whateverism. And the first chapter is called Becoming Christianish. And she includes an epigraph from the book Soul Searching, the book that originally reported on the results of this major survey. She quotes, the passage she quotes expresses the concern that a significant part of Christianity in the United States is actually only tenuously Christian, only superficially connected to the actual historic Christian tradition. And here's what the writers, these are sociologists, okay? These are not fundamentalist pastors. It is not so much that U.S. Christianity is being secularized. Rather, more subtly, Christianity is either degenerating into a pathetic version of itself, or more significantly, Christianity is actively being colonized by quite a different religious faith. So I talked to this woman, Kenda Creasy Dean, and she thinks that the vagueness of this belief that's very well documented among American teens reflects, as I said, the failure of churches in which they are raised to offer a thick and challenging vision of Christian faithfulness. And she noted when we talked about her book that the problem is compounded by parents who don't want their kids. They don't want their kids to pay the high cost of discipleship. She said to me during our conversation, and it's one of the most memorable sentences I've heard in years of doing interviews. She said, one of the things that's really tricky to convey to parents is that if you're trying to form your kids to be Christians, it's not going to fit them very well for American culture. I'm tempted to say, duh, at that point, but that would be too snarky. That should be obvious. I want to ask these parents, why would they assume that there's an easy fit between Christian faithfulness and the expectations of American culture as we now see it? Now, I understand not wanting your kids to feel like misfits as a father. But if you're paying attention to the assumptions about life that undergird our dominant cultural institutions, it should seem obvious that we really should recognize that we are resident aliens here and now. the body of ideas that govern all of our major cultural institutions could be described as a kind of secular materialism. Human beings are just matter that has become self-conscious. The universe is a product of chance and necessity. There is no ultimate purpose behind anything. There is no underlying or overarching human nature that should be honored in our politics, in our commercial life, our art, or our education. It's not just that the culture we live in understands God and sin and morality, that is, religious things, differently than Christians have historically understood them. It understands almost everything in accordance with presuppositions that are largely at odds with the presuppositions of Christian theology. Now, thank God, our non-believing neighbors can't be fully consistent with their presuppositions. They often act better than their beliefs. And we're grateful for that. And because they still have to deal with reality. Finally, their beliefs don't make any sense. You can't account for human experience as purely matter. You can't account for love. You can't account for generosity. You can't account for the kinds of sacrifices parents often make for their children. If all we are is matter, I mean, you can try to on Darwinian terms, but I think it's pretty weak. So the only way to avoid a sense of dis-ease, given how different our culture is, the only way to avoid a sense of dis-ease in such a setting, the only way to fit in or feel like you fit in, whether you're 15 or 50, is to remain Christian-ish, is to not be too Christian. Rather than being deeply and profoundly and thoroughly Christian, many people have a Christian faith, and they may take their beliefs very, very seriously as far as those beliefs go. But it's a short list of beliefs very often. They don't have what theologian Romano Guardini called a Christian consciousness. In a wonderful book in 1957 called Prayer and Practice. And Guardini wrote, consciousness could be called Christian if its particular manner of experiencing, of thinking and judging, caused it to consider true that which is true from the standpoint of divine revelation. To consider possible that which is possible from the standpoint of divine revelation. To consider good, beautiful, noble, satisfying, whatever deserves these attributes as seen from that standpoint. We need only look around us to see that this is so. We do find Christian faith, frequently of a very courageous and pure form. But consciousness seems on the whole completely outside faith. What he means here is the assumptions that we have about reality are not assumptions that are shaped by basic Christian doctrines and ramified Christian doctrines. The assumptions that Christian people have about what is true, what is good, what is beautiful, what is noble, what is possible, those are assumptions often shaped by something other than Christian teaching. And that puts us in a kind of schizophrenic position. The passage that Randy read earlier from Philippians, whatever is true, whatever is honorable, whatever is just, whatever is pure, whatever is lovely, whatever is commendable, if there is any excellence, if there is anything worthy of praise, think about these things. Now, Paul doesn't say whatever you think is true, whatever you think is lovely, whatever you find commendable. It's a good thing to think about it in your personal preference. Does Paul mean that our attentiveness to whatever is just, true, honorable, pure, lovely, etc., will have consequences only with personal salvation and the privacy of our spiritual lives? Or does he believe that when we think about such things, that believers will attempt to live in ways that really are quite different from their neighbors who don't think about such things? And I think that the overwhelming testimony of the New Testament is on that latter option. One of the first great heretics condemned by the church was a man named Marcion. He lived in the second century. Theologian Tertullian described Marcion's theology this way. He said, Marcion posited the existence of two gods, one judicial, harsh, mighty in war, the other mild, placid, and simply good and excellent. The former, the nasty one, was the creator of the world, the God of the Old Testament. The latter was the father of Jesus Christ. In other words, Marcion wanted to distance Jesus and his father from creation and the God that made creation. Marcion also denied that Jesus was fully human. He denied that he played the spirit of the Antichrist, according to John's terms. For him, salvation was about escaping from our embodied life, escaping from all of the material aspects of the world of space and time and matter and motion. And that wasn't something we should really care about, because that was the domain of the nasty Old Testament God, and true faith had nothing to do with this world. That was the first great heresy. And I don't know any parent that's ever named his children Marcy, and ever since then. Maybe it's because it sounds like Martian, I guess. Echoes of that heretical form of dualism continue to haunt the church. And in many conservative churches, a dualism that effectively separates creation from redemption is very, very common. In part because we tended to think of redemption as an escape from creation to a purely spiritual experience. I think the biblical picture, the church, is not simply the fellowship of spiritually, internally, and invisibly renewed people. We're rather a people who recognize the cosmic lordship of Christ and strive to configure our lives as best we can in ways that conform to the kinds of creatures we were meant to be, and in whom, by God's grace, our full humanity will eventually be realized. And so we strive to perceive all aspects of creation rightly. I want to pick up a little bit more on this tomorrow. I have some things I want to add to this. I'll just close on with one strong affirmation about the idea of Christ as Lord of all things. Jesus's miracles testify to his command of all things. He heals the sick. He multiplies loaves and fishes. He calms winds. He turns water into wine. He raises the dead. He displays all of the power and authority that we read about in the Psalms that glorify God as creator. He's the Lord of the material world as well as the spiritual world. He commands demons and the weather with the same authority. And when he commissions the church to pursue the vocation of discipleship, he begins by reasserting that authority. All authority in heaven and on earth has been given to me. The Great Commission isn't handed down by someone who's qualified just because he has great religious insights, or even just because he paid the ultimate penalty for our sins. The Great Commission is given to the Lord, to the church, in the context of Christ's lordship over the cosmos. And the church's work must always have that lordship in view as it makes its disciples, teaching them to observe everything that the cosmic Lord has commanded. He's not just Lord over their emotional lives or their family lives. He's King of Kings and Lord of Lords, and his disciples need to be trained to honor that sovereignty everywhere. The Apostle Paul, very strong in this, he summarizes the redemptive work of Christ as a plan for the fullness of time to unite all things in him, things in heaven and things on earth. The work of redemption, which is centered in Christ, is, in Colossians, linked to the Christocentric work of creation. Colossians 1:15-20, a remarkable passage, and we think that Paul is quoting a hymn that was already being sung in the early church. And he's plagiarizing some really good material here. By him, all things were created in heaven and on earth. All things were created. Jesus is involved in creation. He doesn't show up late after we've sinned. Jesus is there at creation. By him, all things were created in heaven and on earth, visible and invisible, whether thrones or dominions or rulers or authorities. All things were created through him and for him. And he is before all things. And in him, all things hold together. The coherence of everything is tied up in Jesus Christ. The order of the cosmos, including the order of all human life on earth in all of its cultural ramifications, finds its purpose and meaning and worth in Christ. And then, having established the centrality of Christ in all of creation, that hymn goes on to claim that a similar comprehensiveness is in view in Christ's recreative redemption. For in him all the fullness of God was pleased to dwell, and through him to reconcile to himself all things, whether on earth or in heaven, making peace by the blood of his cross. That phrase, on earth and in heaven, it shows up all over the New Testament. And yet we have tended to reduce our understanding of salvation to some disembodied heavenly future. The language that Paul uses here does not give the impression that the gospel is just about transforming our inner lives. Christ, who's the Lord of creation, is also the second Adam. He's the one through whom all the purposes of God for humanity in creation can be rescued. In the words of the third century church father Irenaeus, everything is recapitulated. Everything literally receives a new head in Christ. I'm going to stop there. I'm going to pick up right where we left off tomorrow morning and then move on to the title for the second lecture is, do you have the program there? We're going to talk about how the modern world lost its sense of beauty. I think it's personal period is the title. We're going to talk about how the modern world lost its confidence in the reality of beauty and why that matters. So we'll take a little break and come back, and I'll be glad to answer questions, or I'll try to answer them. Thanks very much.